CataractCoach.com podcast series, episode number 147 with Dr. Andrew Lee, neuro-ophthalmology, neuroadaptation, and neuro-ophthalmology in space with astronauts. You're really going to enjoy this episode. Welcome back to our Cataract Coach podcast. And today, I've got a very special guest who's going to educate us a lot. And that is the world-famous neuro-ophthalmologist, Dr. Andrew Lee. Andy, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Uday.
Now, you're really well-known in the neuro-ophthalmology world. I actually watch and subscribe to your YouTube channel where you've got 100,000 followers. But you really have a well-known personality being a great educator in neuro-ophthalmology, especially for dummies like me who don't know a whole lot of neuro-ophthalmology.
Well, I've learned from the best. That'd be you.
Well, we happened to be together in Dubai recently, and you had a great lecture that I really thought was amazing. I think it was 5 neuro-ophthalmology diagnoses that you cannot afford to miss. Can we talk about those? Those, are, I think, would be a great topic.
Sure. So an ophthalmologist has the opportunity to save someone's life or vision, and I call them Lee's A's: arteritis, giant cell arteritis, apoplexy of the pituitary gland, abscess, which is usually a fungal abscess from mucor, mycosis in immunocompromised people, aneurysm, and that's the rule of the pupil. A pupil-involved third nerve palsy is an aneurysm of the posterior communicating artery until proven otherwise, and arterial dissection, either in the vertebral artery or the carotid, and that presents as a Horner syndrome.
Wow, those 5 A's, those are actually important. Now, they're very unusual, very rare. I don't think I've seen all of those in my career, even in 25 years.
Yeah, the average ophthalmologist over the course of their whole career normally sees one of each of those in their career, like once in 30 years. That's kind of the number you should be having in your head.
So that means, good, I'm only halfway through my career then. I got plenty of time to go to see all this. Now, I mean, one of the things in ophthalmology is now we've become so super sub-specialized. Like, you know, someone sent me a patient and I said, oh, I don't do any retina work. And the guy was shocked. He says, wait a minute, the two things the size of walnuts and you don't do the whole thing? I'm like, yeah, I only do part of the eye. So I think that ends up being an issue because we sometimes don't have enough exposure to these neuro-ophthalmology diagnoses.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So, and that's one of the beauties of the digital platforms is if you don't know, but you know something's not right, you can look it up. And as you mentioned, if you just come to the YouTube site, you can just Google it while you're in the hallway. The patient doesn't have to know that you Googled it, and it'll be you and me in there together. And we'll be able to figure it out together, even if I'm not there in person.
Right. It's like the next step beyond like the Wills manual. I still remember being a first-year resident with my co-residents, and you see a patient, you're not quite sure. You go out in the hallway, look it up in the Wills manual.
Same thing, except phones do it now.
Right. No, I find your lecture series to be really super helpful because you basically go through, you've got hundreds of videos and you go through essentially every neuro-ophthalmology diagnosis that I've even heard of. And you have a brief to the point video about the topic.
Yeah. I mean, it's an analogous probably to what you do. I mean, you've got hundreds of videos just for cataracts. And I'm always impressed by that. So I do the same thing, except for it's everything except cataracts.
Right. No, actually, we're 2,800 videos, and I make a new video every single day.
That's amazing.
Haven't missed a day yet. The other thing that you're actually very well known for is you work with so many medical students. Our podcast tends to be aimed towards the younger ophthalmologists, and oftentimes a lot of medical students who listen who are applying or wanting to get into ophthalmology. And I remember being in the UCLA, the Jewell Stein Institute Residency Selection Committee for many years. I would always see a handful, if not a dozen, letters from you every year.
Yeah, so we have 6 medical schools in Houston, and from those 6 medical schools, we usually generate 25 applicants in the match, and our match rate's about 85 to 90%, so most of our kids get in somewhere, and so my aspirational goal is to be part of the training of 1 in 20 ophthalmologists in the U.S., 5% of U.S. ophthalmology. That's my aspirational goal.
I think you're well on your way of achieving that.
I think we're almost at 4% this year, so I'm trying my best.
Well, I didn't realize there were 6 med schools there. So there's Baylor, there's UT Houston. What else am I missing here?
So we have UTMB, which is in Galveston, part of the medical center. And then we have Texas A&M has a medical school. And then we have Sam Houston State, which is a DO school, and the University of Houston. So we have 6 medical schools.
And that's impressive. And I guess people just are drawn to you naturally because so many med students rotate with you.
Yeah, so we have 100 medical students that rotate with us every year. And 25 each year end up going into ophthalmology.
Yeah, that's a huge number. I don't think that at UCLA, there's no way that many medical students rotate in ophthalmology. Not even close.
Yeah, so I feel lucky that I live in the Texas Medical Center for my work, and all the campuses are very close together. So it's literally they just walk across the street, even though they're from different institutions.
Right. For my listeners who haven't visited ever or don't know about Houston, the Texas Medical Center there in Houston is like the world's biggest medical center. It's unbelievable. It's a city.
Yeah, it's a medical city. It's the largest medical center in the world.
Yeah, I actually remember interviewing there. I interviewed at Baylor when I was applying for residency. I just thought it was an amazing opportunity because not only have obviously good academic programs, which there are many, but you also have those beautiful, the big VA hospital there. And then also you have the Bentov, the kind of the county hospital, which is great hands-on training.
No, for sure. We're fortunate that the city has a county, a VA, very large private institutions. And then we have a freestanding cancer hospital, MD Anderson Cancer Center, which is in the city as well. And we have two children's hospitals and they're all in the same block. So our zip code 77030 probably has more doctors per capita than any zip code on the planet.
Wow. Just the question is when the ambulance driver comes, where do they go? There's so many emergencies.
Well, when the patients come, they say the same thing because it's parking garage number 32 or 37. Right. Which garage should I go to?
Now, when you have the med students rotating, I saw some of your more recent videos. You started a new series of kind of giving advice for the young medical students. Like, hey, the importance of doing an away rotation, which 25 years, 30 years ago when I was applying, I didn't do any away rotations because if you looked great on paper, don't go in person for 3 weeks.
Yeah, so most of our students are doing 3 away electives, 3 rotations, and they're a little bit of an audition elective. It's like the opposite. You have to have good paper and show in person, and then they have signaling where they can tell programs they're actually have dedicated interest in the program. So there's 3 levels now. You have to show interest, you have to do an audition elective, and then you still have to signal.
Do you think it's possible these days to match at a program outside of your own where you're a medical student without doing an audition there, without doing rotation?
It's about 60% end up matching places where they've signaled. So even though the average number of applications is 80-something, really they only need 10 because the majority of people end up places that they signaled. But everybody's doing 80, so they need 80 to get their 10.
Yeah, I think that's a mistake. I think that SF Match program is being a little too generous with allowing you to apply to 80 or 100 programs, which should limit it. Like you can apply to the 25 programs of your choosing.
Yeah. Yeah, so some people apply to all the programs. 80 is the average. So some are doing 120.
But then the problem on the program side, though, is the mountain of applications to go through. And especially now where there's no more USMLE step one score. You used to be able to say, okay, let's have a minimum this step one score and not look at ones below it. But you can't do that anymore.
For sure. And the step two has now become the score that, you know, the metric. So we're looking probably at a 258 is the current score that we're telling our applicants they have to try and get a 258.
So basically like the standard deviation above the mean.
Yes.
Somewhere in that range. Yeah, I guess I was very lucky. You're 3 years, I think, ahead of me. I finished med school in 96. You were 93. So we actually applied at the nadir, at the low point, when it was the least competitive to get into ophthalmology. It is so much more competitive now.
Yeah, for sure. I'm not sure I could get into my own program.
No, if I had applied again now, I'd be doing family practice. I don't think I'd be doing ophthalmology. You also had great advice about kind of knowing as a medical student where you are in the bell curve of things and applying to appropriate programs for the away rotations.
Yes. So we break them into tiers, top tier, middle tier, and a bottom tier. Of course, it's a bell-shaped curve. So that means most of the people are in the middle tier. And if you're two standard deviations from the mean, you're in the top tier. If you're two standard deviations the other way, you're in the bottom tier. And so for our bottom tier applicants, I never tell people they can't apply. I tell them they have to have a plan B. And usually the plan B for the bottom tier people is they have to dual apply. The middle tier people, their plan B is usually do a research year again. And then our top tier people, their plan B is no plan B because they're going to match. It's just a matter of where.
Right. And you also gave great advice that, you know, kind of knowing yourself, if you are one of the top tier med students, very competitive, high board scores, you got AOA, the Honor Society. And if you apply to a lower tier program, you need to explain to them why you're doing that, because they may think, why would you want to come to our program?
Pretty much. Programs, as you said, are receiving hundreds of applications. So each program knows what tier they're in too. And they have empiric historical data on what type of applicant actually chooses them. And so weirdly, if you're a top tier applicant and you're applying to a bottom tier program, which you think is your safety, there's no safety. They're not going to waste an interview on a top tier applicant who has no interest in being there. So the programs know who they are going to end up with. And so they choose to interview people who they know are going to come.
Right. You got to play the odds. You got to play the math. But if you have an incentive, let's say you have a spouse who's in that one particular city, you really want to be there and you're willing to do any program, then you have to get that point across to them.
Yeah, so you definitely have to tell the programs, hey, my husband or wife needs to be in Chicago. They're already here. They work in finance or whatever, or they're going to be in LA. They're an actor or an actress or whatever they are. And if you don't tell the programs this, they won't believe you. So you have to tell them.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard that as well. Like, you know, sometimes if you're a medical student in California and you're applying to some sort of East Coast program, they think, wait a minute, you're not going to leave California. You're not coming here.
Yeah, we have the same problem in Texas. We're like the flyover country. They want to go to California or East Coast. But I think it's changing a little bit. So for Texans, a lot of Texans want to stay in Texas. So we're lucky we live in a place like California where you get your best and brightest actually want to stay.
Yeah, that's for sure. Now, you also have probably the best letters recommendation I've ever read, the most detailed. And you wrote, I've been reading your letters before there was ChatGPT. So clearly you wrote them yourself.
For sure. So the good part is I do know these students, and I do have something personal and individual to say about them. I dislike having, you know, a ChatGPT letter. I want my readers of my letter to know I actually know this person and can vouch for them or not. And it is a little bit of read between the lines, because I do tell them, and I know that some programs take all the letters and just kind of like put them in order, because it's that level of specificity. I can tell you who's our top applicant, who's our top tier applicant, who's our middle applicant. And I think that's helpful to programs to know that someone who's seen 100 students in a year can tell you which one's number one and which one's number 51.
Right. You know, well, the other thing I found out too, being involved with residents for 22 years at UCLA, was that, you know, it's funny, every year of every class of 8 residents, one or two are superstars, smarter than I ever was. Most are pretty reasonable, good residents like me. And every year, maybe every other year, there's always a stinker. And no matter what, you can't figure out what is the way of not avoiding that stinker. I think you can. I think every program I've talked to just ends up every year, every other year, with someone who's just not a great fit for the program.
Yeah, so that's why I think that audition elective thing works both ways. It's meant to see about fit and fitness. Will this person fit? And there's just some people, you meet them and you know, I could not live with this person for 3 years. They would drive me crazy. Even though on paper they're super smart and they may even be really great people, but they're just something that rubs you the wrong way about them. And you're like, I cannot work with this person.
Well, that's a good point. It's not only fit, but also fitness. That's actually an important concept.
It's both. And there's some people who are really, really great, but only in one domain. And then an expertise in that domain doesn't guarantee expertise in the other domain. So for me, it's always amazing that someone like yourself can pick a surgeon. How do you decide if someone's a good surgeon? We really don't have good metrics for that. Like, they could be super smart, but they have hands of stone. So it's really interesting to me how selection committees can pick for surgeons.
Well, part of it is kind of our hands are tied, to be frank. So I think, you know, if you ask, well, can we put all the med students who come and interview in person? Back in the days before Zoom interviews, can we put them all in the surgical simulator for a 5-minute trial just to see what they do? Well, the question is that against the American with Disabilities Act? Wow.
Yeah, unless you can show that it actually correlates with performance, it probably wouldn't fly. It's an interesting question is how do you pick a good surgeon?
Yeah, I think there certainly is a bell curve of everything in life, including dexterity, let's say, or hand-eye coordination. But I think another part that we kind of sometimes don't pay enough attention to is the drive of that person. Like my example was a great resident should be able to do what I call 10, 10, 10, 10 sutures of 10 on nylon in 10 minutes in the wet lab. Can you do that? And now I'll tell you now, it'll take most people, including me, 500 sutures of practice to get that, but you can do it. But what I end up finding is that most residents didn't even, at least half the residents didn't put in the effort and that I'm good enough. There's not enough drive.
Yeah, I think that's a very difficult thing to measure is ambition, gumption, grit. These are difficult things to assess on paper and even in an audition elective where they're putting their best face on. But yeah, there's just some people that have it and some people that don't. But it's also like what you said, sometimes the person that's the superstar, you wouldn't have predicted that.
Right, right.
So it works both ways. We've literally had people who I thought on paper were just okay, but they were the superstar. But if it makes us feel any better, Uday, like the professional leagues, like National Football League, they spend millions of dollars on psychiatrists and the combine, and they have statisticians and moneyball people that just all their job is to predict performance. And there are people who have won the Heisman Trophy, and then they're a washout as a rookie in the professional league. So it's not unique to us. Even multi-million dollar stakes encounters where you're betting the entire franchise on a quarterback and they just are a bust.
Yeah, that's so true. Because if you look at like it's not always the first round draft picks who end up being the superstars. Sometimes the absolute superstars were picked in the fourth, fifth, sixth round and they weren't top choice.
Yeah, that's Tom Brady. Right. Tom Brady was like the seventh quarterback picked in the draft. He was the 199th pick, but he's the greatest of all time. So I think that a lot of other fields probably feel our pain in terms of how do you draft someone and what metrics are we using? And you still end up with either a superstar from someone you wouldn't have expected, but also busts. And to your point, I think that people like Tom Brady are picked and they're picked for numbers. But the thing that's really matters is heart and ambition and drive. And there's no metric for it. So you can't measure it. And that's an interesting thing about human beings.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up the whole NFL thing because now like it makes sense. Yeah, they do spend millions upon millions trying to figure this out. And they can't figure it out, so our resident program is not going to figure it out either.
That's exactly right.
But for us, I think the important thing was just finding the right fit, because you know what your program offers. And so one of my favorite interview questions, I actually only had two interview questions. We had UCLA did very fast interviews, so you can interview everyone. And I only had two. My two questions were, one, I asked, tell me, what have you taught yourself outside of ophthalmology, outside of medicine, in the last few years? In other words, can you teach yourself? Because as you know now, and what I don't do any surgery the way I was taught it. It's evolved over the last 25 years. That was my one question. What do you think about that question? I'll tell you my second one.
Well, I think that's getting to the heart of what you're really asking is, show me something that's not on this paper and give me an example that's credible, authentic, and advances you as an applicant beyond your competitors. So I think that kind of question gets to the heart of something that you're interested in, which is a self-directed, motivated person who has interests outside of medicine. So I think that that's a really great question.
Right. No, for sure. I think that works really well. My second question was, one day you'll be finishing up a long day of work and you'll drive home and you'll say to yourself, wow, that was a great day of residency. And then I say, okay, describe me what you would think would be an amazing day of residency. And you better be describing our program because that's all I've got to offer you.
Well, I think that's an excellent question as well. And so in the application process, there are questions very similar to your questions. One of those questions that they ask, which is the prompt, is describe your ideal program. So yours would be describe your ideal day, but really they're getting at the same kind of issue. And as you said, it better align with what your program has to offer.
Right, no, for sure, because that's all there is. Like when I was teaching residents, I was at the big county hospital where we had, I mean, a line of patients out the door every day. And so if you want to start the day at like 8:45 with a latte and have a discussion first, I mean, I already got 50 patients waiting. Yeah. So we need to get on top of this. So we're here to move. So you've got to basically describe our program.
Yeah, 50 patients is my entire week.
Well, yeah, neuro-ophthalmology, obviously patients are less. This is just your general eye clinic in the county hospital where...
Oh, my God.
It looks like Bentall, let's say.
Yeah, for sure.
But I think it's also great work ethic is really important. But that's probably the differentiator. Everyone's smart. I learned this in ophthalmology. Believe me, everyone's smart. They're not a dummy in the building when it comes to ophthalmology. And then they just differentiate, ends up being, like you said, the grit, the work ethic.
Totally.
And then when you're applying, I also like this advice you had, which was, once you get the interview, you're all on a level playing field. Now your test scores and your grades and these, that didn't matter. That was just to get you in the door for the interview. On interview day, everyone's kind of on the same playing field. And let's see who's the best fit and who has the best fitness for our program.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I always tell the applicants too, when you are doing surgery on someone or you're being their doctor, they don't ask you what your step two score is. Nobody cares. Yeah. Nobody asks me if I was AOA or not. They don't care. So it's the same process. The process gets you in the door, but you have to go through it. And with patients, nobody cares about your step two score.
Right. I mean, patients don't even know what step means. They have no idea. Let's also talk one thing I really wanted to ask you about, too. Now, we've seen a lot of increase here in new type of IOLs, multifocal, et cetera, which are very different than the human optical system. And we always tell patients that it's a neuro adaptation. Yeah. Is that a thing?
I for sure. And it goes the other way too, where the patients who don't neural adapt have these complaints. They see that shadow, or they have this perception that something's in their temporal field, either negative or a positive dysphotopsia. Right. And they, of course, they end up in neuro-op because we're the repository of all these people. Especially when the cataract surgery looks completely fine, like it's perfect, the surgery. So I totally believe this. And there's good empiric evidence that there are things that can be done to improve their neuroplasticity and help them get their brain to adapt. And it's actually amazing that the types of lenses that you guys put in there don't cause it more often. This is a completely foreign and non-physiologic thing that you're doing with these multifocal lenses. But as you know, they kind of just adapt over time. But then there's this small segment of the population, they just can't adapt.
Yeah, if you think about it, like with a trifocal lens, you're now putting three different images on the retina at the same time?
Yeah, it's a completely non-physiologic state. And yet most people are happy with it. So I find it fascinating the other way. Why doesn't everybody complain about it? It is the proof that neuroplasticity exists.
Right. Yeah, for the negative dysphotopsia, I try to explain to patients, do you ever put glasses on? Do you see the glasses frame? After a while, you don't see it anymore. So just let's hang in there a little bit. And the other thing is understanding a patient reporting something to you versus complaining about it. They're not the same.
For sure. And if you take the time to explain it to them, they probably stop complaining about it. But I think most people actually have that. They just don't complain about it. It's what you said. They have it. They just don't care.
Right. I had a patient today I was talking to. Today, I'm going for a dense, brunescent cataract, traumatic cataract, very tough case. And his pre-op vision was either hand motion or he felt the air, so I'll call it wind perception, one or the other. Very little vision. I mean, so much so we couldn't see his retina. I had to use an ultrasound or do his axial length measurement. I couldn't use optical methods. By some miracle, he ends up absolutely plano. And now he's though he reads 20/20 in the Snellen chart, has terrible complaints about the night vision so bad, I wish I had the cataract back in my eye. And he's like, I don't know what to do here. Can I send him to neuro-ophthalmology?
Please don't.
I mean, what advice do you have for me here? I'm at a loss. I don't know what to say.
Well, I think there's just some people who cannot be made happy. Yeah, they just right. can't. So you're not their psychiatrist, I guess is what I would say.
But now, yeah, he's just like, oh, no, the nighttime dysphotopsias, I can't drive at night. This is crazy. This is worse than when I had the cataract. Like, seriously? I was like, well, why don't you come back? I'll put the cataract back in your eye. Can I just, like, get an opaque IOL and just stick it in there instead?
Well, I think that is something that we do sometimes. We put an opaque contact lens on people and say, here's what you had before. You sure you want this back? Here, put this on.
Yeah, I guess it's maybe I didn't set a reasonable expectation then. I should expect, you know. But I try to explain this is a man-made body part. And whether you're talking about a lens implant, a heart valve, or an artificial hip, there are no man-made body parts that are as good as being young and healthy and human. None.
I agree, but people want to be perfect, I guess.
Right, right. What other challenging cases do you think get sent to you, especially, let's say, related to prior surgery?
So the things that we see from cataract surgery that are problematic is sometimes we see ischemic optic neuropathy that happened to occur within the cataract surgery window 30 days or so. I would say most of those cases aren't related to their surgery at all, but the patients think it's related.
Right.
The other thing that we've seen is the pupil sometimes gets affected in some of the anterior segment procedures, DSEC, where there's a little bit of air bubble in there and it causes the shock to the iris and causes a pupil that's stuck open, uretzivalia, we call it. And we see that sometimes. Otherwise, I think cataract surgery has really gotten a lot better. We used to see strabismus after cataract surgery, but we don't see that anymore.
Is that like from the blocks damaging the extraocular muscles?
From the blocks, we don't see that. We used to see a lot of ptosis people. We don't see that anymore. So I think what you guys have done technology-wise in terms of the surgery itself, the incision, the recovery time, has made a lot of the post-cataract neurop just go away, which is great. I think it's really great.
Yeah, it's tough with the NAON where it comes in just in that 30-day post-op period. You're like, it's just bad luck.
It is just bad luck. So I really actually don't believe the 30-day people. I don't believe the two-week people even. The ones I believe the most are like when the IOP spiked and they had it that day. Mm. Those ones I'm much more likely to believe. But all the other ones, I really don't believe those. Those are just coincidence, not causation.
Now, a question that gets asked to me all the time by patients, and I don't have a great answer, is the use of these GLP-1 medications like Wegovy, Ozempic, Mounjaro, and the risk of NAION. Teach me something.
Well, so that one's another association is not causation. We know that if people on GLP-1 agonists are on it for some reason, because they're a vascular path, because they're obese, because they have risk factors. And so separating out which is the chicken and which is the egg is difficult. There's a signal there, that's for sure. The data is showing there is a signal. And there is a biologically plausible mechanism for this. As you might remember in the diabetic studies, over rigorous control of diabetes made diabetic retinopathy worse. Mm-hmm. In some patients, and it was presumed to be autoregulatory failure. So the same type of autoregulatory failure that it can occur from rapid weight loss in diabetics probably is the best mechanism for something that's supposed to help you actually harming you. But on balance, if you look at these drugs and how they reduce cardiac and cerebrovascular mortality and morbidity rates, that benefit is probably way higher than the small risk of NAION. And it's probably a small number, X, 2X to 7X of a small number already. So to me, the jury is still out on GLP-1 and NAION. I think you are obligated to know that it exists and be able to speak intelligently to the patient when they come, because they're just going to Google it anyway.
Right. So it's important to differentiate for the patient that it's not causation. It's a loose association.
I think that's what it is. So if you look at things like here in at our beach in Galveston, shark attack and ice cream sales are definitely correlated. But the shark attack and the ice cream are in July, and that's our highest peak month. So if you don't eat ice cream, you still might get a shark attack.
That's a funny example, but I think it hammers home the point where, yeah, it's obviously not causation. It's just associated because there are more people there, obviously.
Yeah, and weirdly, Nicolas Cage movies are also associated with shark attack and ice cream sales, because the type of movie that he does is that summer blockbuster movie. And so there's definitely an association between Nicolas Cage movies, shark attack, and ice cream sales.
Wow. Now, on another topic, you ever see patients who have complications, neuro-ophthalmology complications from cosmetic treatments, a lot of these fillers? We've had a lot of these patients now. Have you seen this?
Yeah. So as you know, your face is highly vascular, and there anastomoses, existing anastomoses. So any injection in the face area, the lid or the lip, these fillers can go retrograde and right into the ophthalmic, even though these are external carotid arteries. But if you push the plunger hard enough, your pushing can exceed the arterial pressure. And so we have seen filler and the vehicle. We've seen steroid inadvertent in the ophthalmic and in the center retinal artery from external injections, including the nose, the face, lip, all can just get right into your eye.
Wow. Yeah, it just makes you wonder about it. Like every time I see a patient come in with these exaggerated lips, I just think, like, you know, if nothing else, that's very high risk of the drainage into the cavernous, the danger triangle into the cavernous sinus. Like, why would you inject this in your face?
Yeah, no amount of beautiful lips is worth blindness.
Right. Just crazy, crazy stuff. Now, what are patients who have, another issue we got is patients with chronic pain after cataract surgery. Now, you'd think it's not going to be a painful surgery because you're putting the lens in the capsular bag, which has no nerve supply. But yet they come with chronic complaints. How do you diagnose this or kind of figure this out?
Yeah, so we've seen some of these. They're, pain without any stain. Their cornea looks fine. The surgery looks fine. And a lot of those end up having small fiber neuropathy. So the confocal microscope has helped us identify some of those people from the faking people or the people who just have really low pain thresholds. And in the confocals of those patients with the small fiber corneal neuropathy, they have their corneal nerves regenerated after the corneal incision or LASIK or whatever was done, but they didn't regenerate properly and they went around in a circle. So the confocal shows either decreased nerve numbers or they're all aberrantly innervated. And so this corneal neuralgia is a form of small fiber neuropathy, a pain without stain. So I think it's really been helpful for us to see the confocal microscopy on these people, especially if they have pre-existing disease that favors an autonomic or small fiber neuropathy like diabetes or some other neuropathy predisposing risk factor.
Yeah, I guess that's important to look at. I haven't even thought about looking with a confocal microscope to see those nerves.
Yeah, and then you can say, oh, I believe you. And it doesn't make it any easier to deal with the person, but at least you have the answer.
How do you resolve it?
Neuropathic pain medicines. We also have some newer topical treatments with nerve growth factor that have potential to increase innervation and modulate it. So it remains to be seen what the best treatment is. But we face the same problem with small fiber neuropathy elsewhere in the body. So it's not unique to the cornea. But of course, the cornea is the most innervated organ in the body, so they feel it more.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. You also have a lot of work. Tell me about your projects with NASA and space. Now, this is really cool.
Yeah, so as you know, Houston is the home for the Johnson Space Center. So made famous by that quote, Houston, we've had a problem. But Houston was also the first word spoken from the moon on July 20th, 1969. Houston, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed. So Houston is the home for mission control. And I just happen to be the closest neuro-ophthalmologist to the Space Center. So the condition, spaceflight-associated neurocular syndrome, is a condition of spaceflight. It is an extraterrestrial disorder. And as you know, the gravitational field of this planet is pulling down on your fluids. And all our physiologic processes are devoted to maintaining our blood pressure against gravity. And so when the astronauts go into space and the microgravity, because the space station is in free fall in a low Earth orbit, they have microgravity. And so the fluid just gets stuck up here in the orbit and in their head. This fluid compresses the eye and causes the axial shortening and a hyperopic shift, choroidal folds and disc edema. And we call that SANS, spaceflight associated neurocular syndrome.
So interesting. So they become hyperopic in space.
They do. And we used to have to send special glasses up with them. But now, of course, there's enough reading glasses so they don't have to do that.
So someone like me who's a minus two myope, I'd be perfect. I'd be hyperopic in space.
Yeah. So you might have spaceflight associated refractive syndrome.
So what are the long-term effects of this? So people stay in the space station, let's say, for months or even a year. What's the long-term effect?
Yeah, so that's one of the interesting things is we didn't see it in the short duration flights. It's a disorder that requires a little bit of longer duration spaceflight on the order of 30 to 90 or more days. But we know it develops on the station because on the station there's OCT2 and photography and ultrasound. So we can see it's developing over time. And fortunately, there's no permanent vision loss. Nobody's had a permanent visual field defect. There's nobody went blind. So the good part is it doesn't blind anybody. And weirdly, the treatment is just come home, return to the gravitational field of the planet. So ET, come home. So it's an extraterrestrial disorder for which the treatment is return to the terrestrial gravitational field.
When they come back to Earth, how long before, let's say, the ocular system kind of goes back to normal?
Yeah, so it takes several months to get back to normal. The disc edema and the choroidal folds take that long to go away. As you know, just like on Earth, sometimes the choroidal folds, they don't go away, and the axial shortening sometimes doesn't go away, and they're stuck with reading glasses that they didn't have before. But some of our myo patients, they felt better.
Right. Wow, that's so interesting. Is there any long-term damage then from having this disc edema for a prolonged period of time when you're in space? I can't think it's good.
Yeah, so that's the great part about it. It really hasn't caused any optic neuropathy, optic atrophy, or fiber layer loss. So it seems to be a mechanical problem rather than a structural problem that causes damage. It's not like a brain tumor or aneurysm. It really just goes away.
Wow, that's so interesting. There's no like field defect, nerve fiber layer looks normal afterwards.
Yeah, so that's the good part. We don't really have any permanent vision loss. So it's a problem, but it's luckily it's not a life-threatening problem and it's not a blinding problem.
So we are designed for basically Earth's gravity, humans. When we colonize Mars, it's gonna be a problem too.
Yeah, so you evolve to be in a 1G environment on planet Earth, and when you go off planet, your body doesn't like it. The G on Mars is about 1/3 of the gravity of the Earth, and the moon is about 1/8. So that when they build a lunar base, they'll be facing the same type of problem. But I'm hopeful that 1/8 gravity is going to be enough to prevent it from happening.
Yes, so interesting. Now I got to ask you, why haven't we gone back to the moon?
Money. Yeah. Also, the novelty has worn off, but the plan is to have a lunar base and a staging area for a planned trip to Mars. Of course, I'm not involved in the planning of that, and I'm not going.
Right.
I'm interested in the neuro-ophthalmology of the spaceflight.
Yeah, I just didn't realize though. But I guess before we didn't realize this either, right? This is a relatively new phenomenon. We've had the space station, space lab for decades. But I never heard about this until the last couple of years.
Yeah, it's a new phenomenon. It didn't happen in shorter duration flights. So it's been quite a journey for me too, because I never in a million years thought that I would be involved in the neuro-ophthalmology of space flight.
Right. So you were saying they have some of this diagnostic equipment up in space. I did not even realize. They have an OCT scanner?
Yes, OCT, ophthalmic photography, orbital ultrasound. We have IOP as well, and that was one of the initial hypotheses was maybe it was hypotony, because here on Earth, as you know, you can get choroidal folds and disc edema from low pressure, but we know it's not low pressure in the eye because the pressure goes up a little bit and then it stabilizes out, so it wasn't hypotony.
Wow, so interesting. I didn't realize this was all available in while you're thousands of miles up in space.
Yeah, and the other weird thing about it is that they do all these tests on themselves. There's no ophthalmic technician, so literally ask do their own OCT and fundus photograph on themselves.
So interesting. Yeah, there've been multiple, I think multiple astronauts who had were physicians, but I don't think any ophthalmologists.
No.
Wow, it's very cool stuff. How did you even get involved in this? Just because you're, I guess, the most prominent neuro-ophthalmologist, especially in Houston?
Yeah, I was the closest, is the short answer.
But let's talk also a little bit more about neuro-ophthalmology. So a lot of residents who listen to this podcast, there's actually a growing interest, I think, in neuro-ophthalmology. But that's one of the subspecialties where it's been a little bit tough sometimes to fill fellowship spots.
Yeah, we've been lucky that we have international graduates who are interested in neurop, and we have neurologists. So as opposed to some of the other subspecialties which are having difficulty filling, we have neurology and we have internationals, and so it's helped fill the gap. And so neuro-ophthalmology is still alive and well.
For sure. Now, are there more programs that are involving more surgical aspects of neuro-ophthalmology as well, as opposed to just medical?
Yeah, totally. So one of the things that we learned at the organizational level is, why don't people choose neurop? Their number one was no surgery. That was the number one reason for not picking neuro-ophthalmology as an ophthalmology resident. The number two was, of course, compensation disparity. And the number three was the perceived difficulty of the specialty. So some of the things we can't do anything about, but the one we can do something about is the surgery piece. And so a lot of neuro-ophthalmology fellowships are going to combined neurop and orbit, or neurop and strabismus. Those are the two most common pairings for neuro-ophthalmic fellowship. And it has made a difference. I think there's a lot more people interested in doing those combined programs where they get to do some surgery.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I think it's will grow in popularity then with that.
Totally. Although we haven't had any neurop cataracts fellowships. maybe we could work on that one together.
I don't know how we'd fit that together, but especially because the lens doesn't have any nerve fibers that I know of. But clearly, obviously, it all relates together, especially like we were talking about earlier about the neuroadaptation, which to me, I still, I guess, don't understand why patients love so much having three images on the retina at once. It's
would be like big. It does have adaptation. That is a completely non-physiologic state. So it's like I said, I'm amazed that you guys can do that and everybody isn't complaining.
Yeah, generally, I think the math is that there's a, if you do a multifocal or trifocal lens, but a 99% of patients or 98% of patients say, yeah, they like it, they do it again. It's exceedingly rare. I think our explantation rate is 1% or less of doing eyeball exchange.
That's amazing.
But it's also kind of the way we present it to the patients. I present it in two very simple kind of groups. That if you want a monofocal, if that's that kind of style of lens, I say, I'll give you the best image quality I got, the best night driving, really minimal glare and halos, but you got to wear readers. Or I said, I'll give you the opposite. I give you no readers, but in order to achieve that, you have to sacrifice some of the quality of vision, especially at night. And then which one do you fall in? And they're like, well, I can sacrifice a little. I don't mind. Well, then that's going to be an easygoing patient.
No, I think it's part of the art of medicine. What you do is finding the right lens for the right person. And the pre-surgical judgment is really an incredible part of what we do. Otherwise, you know, you could just be technically good. So you have to be technically good, but you have to still be the people person.
Right. I mean, that's probably the hardest thing to teach and learn is surgical judgment.
Yes. I think that's one of the saving graces for the emergence of AI. There'll still be a place for people like us who are people.
How are you using AI now in your work or your projects?
Yeah. So the AI is very good for doing the nuts and bolts kind of things. It's really good for taking tedious work out of there, but we still have to check it. So I use it for answering questions quickly and having it formatted. And then I can look at it. Okay, that was not true. Hallucination, I can take it out. So my role is the AI does all the grunt work. And I think that's what you alluded to before. A lot of letters of recommendation are going to be AI in the future, I think. But I still have to be the personality behind it. For me, I still enjoy writing the letters, but AI to me is going to take a lot of people's jobs. It's just a matter of what are people going to do with the AI. And I think what's going to happen is AI is not going to take ophthalmologist jobs, but the ophthalmologist who is using the AI is going to take somebody's job. So that is really what's going to happen.
No, I think there's a lot of truth to that. You know, a friend and I were working on a patent for AI related to IOL calculations, which we received the patent.
Oh.
Yeah, we also received another one in keratofractive surgery using AI to do the kind of calculations and programming for the excimer laser or femtosecond laser for keratorefractive surgery.
Yeah, I think that's an appropriate use of that technology. That was the grunt work, the tedious part, but it's still your job to do the people part and, you know, explaining it and making sure it's correct. But the machines are going to do all the tedious work.
Yeah, and I think the models have gotten better and better, because even if now I ask a very, very specific topic, tell me about the effect of a shallow anterior chamber in the setting of a normal axial length in someone with pseudo exfoliation and poor dilation.
Yeah.
And it'll give me a really good answer. And now a year ago, it's probably 80% accurate. Now it is 95% accurate. It's getting better.
For sure. And I use it that same way for very, very specific questions. It's very good. And it comes up with 10 things, and maybe I would have gotten 8 of them, but the number 9 and 10, I'm like, oh, that's really an interesting idea. So it's really great for that, which is generating a list of things that you can then expand upon, but you wouldn't have come up with that by yourself, or it would have taken you days, and that thing can do it in seconds.
Now, with your, clearly brilliant neuro-ophthalmology mind, for decades you specialize in just this one little narrow field of medicine. How accurate is AI or these large language models when it comes to your specific, very narrow topics?
Yeah, it's good for answering general questions. It's really great for basic types of things, and it's great for generating ideas. But I don't think it's going to replace neuro, because the complexity is in the decision making. I view my role is using AI to generate the tedious work, to format the note, et cetera. But it's still my job to put the big picture together. And the danger of the AI is it's immoral. It just does. It's not trying to be bad. It's not trying to hallucinate, but it doesn't feel bad about it either. So
right.
That's where human beings really have to be engaged and involved in the empathy pieces and the validation pieces. An AI will just flat out hallucinate a reference and lie to you and will not feel bad about it at all.
Right. Whereas if we get a diagnosis wrong, we feel guilty about it.
Yes. So maybe in the future they will be able to program in the personality and the empathy and the compassion piece. And, you know, no sci-fi movie with AI ever ends well for the humans. So I'm hoping that this doesn't happen to us.
That is true. I mean, this is becoming more like that Terminator, the T2 Terminator movie, right? It's like, oh my gosh, this is exactly what the movie was.
Yeah, there's no AI movie where the humans come out good.
Well, hopefully this will be the exception then. But we also think about, well, so far we've fed basically the AI all of this human-produced data. These articles, these videos, these whatever it is, all. But now AI is generating more and more of the things that are going online.
Sure.
AI is just teaching AI?
And that's the danger, is once it gets to that point, then it won't need the humans anymore. So that's the danger, and that's what the sci-fi plot lines are always, that the AI just starts talking to itself.
Yeah, I guess. But what I like it most of all for is these crazy problems where, like for lens calcs, if there are 20 different formulas, you know what that means? That means none of them are right. if you have a correct formula, it is the one formula. There's only one Pythagorean theorem. There's no alternative.
For sure.
So for these lens calcs, obviously 20 different formulas means none are right. So it's kind of helpful to use this AI as like a chess engine, but for the game of lens calcs.
And that was kind of... I think it's a perfect use of it.
Yeah, but I guess time will tell. More. Now, my big wish, though, is I wish the AI would edit my surgical videos for me. But I think we're not quite there yet, because that takes a lot of time to edit videos.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's where machine learning and learning to do what you do is that's going to be the next generation of AI is doing things that require your level of expertise. And so I think your job is still safe, Uday.
Yeah, I still think it's a great time to be an ophthalmologist. I think we're all going to be just fine. And anything else you want to relate to our audience? I really enjoyed our discussion. We've been talking almost an hour here. I can't believe it.
No, I really enjoyed chatting with you, Uday. And it's great that someone of your caliber is engaging young people. And I know when I travel, I see you more around the world than I see you in LA. So I'm looking forward to seeing you anywhere in the world.
Oh, thank you so much. Yeah, I think it's super important. I think you're doing the same thing by teaching an amazing number of basically 5% of future American ophthalmologists. That is wild. I love it. That's amazing. So keep up the good work, Andy.
Well, thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Remember, our listeners and viewers, got a new Cataract Coach podcast every Sunday on Apple, Amazon, Spotify, Google. Everywhere you find a podcast, find the Cataract Coach podcast. Plus, of course, we have a new Cataract Coach video every single day. 2,800 videos and counting. Coming up July of 2026, we're going to have video number 3,000. So until next week, I'll catch you later.